Well, good morning.
Good morning.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Some verses from Isaiah chapter 61. We will greatly rejoice in the Lord. Our whole being shall exult in God, for he has clothed us with the garments of salvation, covered us with the robe of righteousness, as a bridegroom decks himself with a garland, and as a bride adorns herself with jewels. For as the earth brings forth its shoots, and as a garden causes what is sown in it to spring up, so the Lord God will cause righteousness and praise to spring up before all the nations. Gracious God, we thank you that in our baptism you have clothed us in the garments of your own faithfulness, and they have become our wedding garments, as you have taken us to yourself to have and to hold from this time forth and even forevermore. Let us this day relax into that comfort of your embrace. And while we are held there this day, may we learn in this hour together from your scriptures ways that we might be the ripple effect of your love throughout all the world. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
All you peaceful people have already had yoga. Good morning. My name is Fred Niedner from Valparaiso, Indiana, where I teach theology, biblical studies at Valparaiso University. And this is the second last of 10 sessions that I will have done up here this summer, giving context to the theme verse for the summer, where the river flows, life abounds, from Ezekiel 47, the vision of the life-giving river that flows from the temple that Ezekiel sees in his vision. And we've given context to the verse, but we've also given context to Ezekiel's ministry during the time of the exile, when Israel had lost absolutely everything and the whole symbol system of their faith had fallen apart. The promises of God seemed to have come to naught, and they were rebuilding. Today and tomorrow, we'll be starting yesterday already, we're starting to see where all the ripple effects of Ezekiel's work went. And mostly in the New Testament, it goes into the Johannine literature. I sometimes tell my students back home that we could have a whole semester's work just on how the prophecy of Ezekiel impacted the gospel that we know as John and the strange apocalyptic visions in the book of Revelation. We'll be in both places today. By the end of the day, you'll wonder how often can the same person start in Genesis and end up in Revelation in 1 hour and get away with it. That's what we're doing once again today. Alleged hilarity. Someone did inform me, someone in the village informed me yesterday that there are actually three kinds of people. There are those who can count and those who can't. Someone with a mathematician's son. So now you know the fool. I'm going to read something today that goes with the theme that we're working on today. And let me warn you all ahead of time that what we're going to do today is about marriage and betrothal as an image for the relationship of God and God's people. And I have done what I'm going to do today a couple of other times over the years of Holden. I think the last time was about 7 years ago. So this isn't absolutely new, and some of you will have done this perhaps with someone else elsewhere. But I am working today with the theory that wherever two or three are gathered together who have not done this, it is worth doing again. But I'm going to start in a strange place. I have the perverse habit of snipping out from the newspaper items that talk about marital misfortune, because there's a lot of it. And one of the best places is in the advice columns of the newspaper. And for years I've been hauling around this old column, an Ann Landers column. And this is at least 25 years old, but I love it. Dear Ann Landers, I've been married to Louise, not her real name, for 30 years. For the most part, we've had a good marriage, but Ann, there's something about Louise that drives me crazy, and I don't know how much longer I can take it. On our wedding night, as we unpacked our things in a lovely little hotel honeymoon suite, Louise pulled out of her luggage an accordion. I didn't even know she played the accordion. But she played on and on that evening through several rounds of Lady of Spain and some drinking songs with surprisingly ribald lyrics. I was stunned. I had no idea Louise played the accordion or that it was so important to her. She takes it with us everywhere. Honestly, Anne, she doesn't play that well, and she only knows a few tunes. It's very hard to listen to. Here's the worst part. Louise and I have never had much of a social life. In fact, our only real friends are Bernice and Murray. Whenever we get together, Louise gets out her accordion, and Bernice and Murray join in. Murray makes musical sounds, by rapping on the top of his head while opening and closing his mouth to produce changes in tone. Bernice clacks two spoons together to keep rhythm. What can I do, Anne? I love my wife, but this racket is driving me crazy. Signed, Had It on Long Island. So you got to know what Anne answered, right?
Yeah.
Dear Had It, you've been truly wonderful. Please don't blow 30 years of sainthood by losing your temper now. Surprise Louise with a dozen accordion lessons and several pieces of sheet music. Sorry, I can't think of a thing you can do about Bernice and Murray. So even the best marriages have their trials. There's an accordion out there somewhere in everybody's relationship. So the excuse for doing this is the fact that the living water that flows from Ezekiel's vision ends up even in wells. And so we're going to do a bunch of the Bible's well stories this morning, and they are in one way or another the stories of marriage, and they end up being the story of our marriage and Jesus' marriage. Dan Brown was right, you know, Jesus did get married. He just has the wrong fiance identified in his work. I'll show you the real bride. We're going to start in Genesis and go to Revelation, and today we go back to Genesis 24. So if you have a Bible with you, please start there. We're just going to look at some stories, and the first one is 60-some verses, so we're going to have to zip through it and skip some parts. Otherwise, we would never finish. But we'll look at these stories, and then we'll stop and we'll try to figure out what's going on in these tales. Genesis 24. Abraham was old, well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his house, who had charge of all that he had, "Put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and earth, that you will not get a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but will go to my country and to my kindred and get a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said, "Well, perhaps the woman may not be willing to follow me to this land. Must I then take your son back to the land from which you came?" Abram said to him, "See to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and swore to me, 'To your offspring I'll give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath of mine. Only you must not take my son back there." So the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. So this is the mission. Find a wife from back in the old country, from the people where Sarah and I came from. Find a wife for son Isaac. We don't want him marrying one of the locals, like Ishmael did. That was trouble. So we want our own kind. So the servant goes off, and he takes 10 of his master's camels and a whole lot of stuff, and he sets out for the land from which Abram and Sarai have come. And when he gets there, he makes the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water. It was toward evening, the time when women go out to draw water. And the servant prays. And he prays, O Lord God of my master, let just the right woman come, and let this be the sign that she's the one, that when she finishes, that she'll offer me water, and when she finishes giving me water, she'll say, how about if I water your camels too? Well, before he had finished his prayer, there was Rebekah, born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, coming out with her water jar on her shoulder. The girl was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, came up. The servant ran to meet her and said, please let me sip a little water from your jar. Drink, my lord, she said, and quickly lowered her jar. And as soon as she does that, she says, how about if I draw for your camels, too, until they've all finished drinking? Ta-da! Prayer is answered. This is the one! The man gazed at her in silence, just to make sure this is the one the Lord had picked, and the journey successful. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold nose ring weighing half shekel and two bracelets for her arms weighing 10 gold shekels and said, so, whose daughter are you? Waving his gold around. She says who she is, daughter of Bethuel. She says, we got plenty of place for you to stay. The man bowed his head and blesses God for having given him such success. The girl ran and told her mother's household about all these things, verse 28. Her brother Laban, when he hears about the gold, he runs out there and invites the man in. Come in, O blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside when I've prepared the house and a place for the camels? So the man goes in, and they sit down to hospitality for a meal. And the servant tells the entire story of who he is, where he comes from, how he prayed, and how, sure enough, when Rebecca came, she did exactly what he had asked for in his prayer. And Laban finally concludes verse 50. Sounds like it comes from the Lord. What you're telling me rings true. So here's Rebecca. Take her and go. Let her be the wife of your master's son. Well, when the servants hear about all this, among other things, they want to try to find a way to get a little bit more of that gold. But they also are wondering whether this girl really wants to go, and her mother isn't all that thrilled about letting her go immediately, so they decide to leave it up to her. Will you go or not? And she says in verse 58, I will. And so they sent away their sister Rebecca and her nurse along with Abram's servant and his men. They blessed her. She took her maids and some of her own camels and so forth, and she goes with the servant back to the place where Isaac is waiting for them. And when Isaac hears the report of how it has all transpired, Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebecca and she became his wife, and he loved her. And so Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. That's the first story. Without further ado, Genesis chapter 29, the next generation. Jacob, the son of these two, Isaac and Rebekah, is traveling in the same territory where he has gone, not because he's been dispatched to find a wife, but because he's fleeing the wrath of his brother who he just cheated out of their inheritance. And Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the people of the east, and he looked, he saw a well in the field and three flocks of sheep lying there beside it, for out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said, "My brothers, where do you come from?" They said, "We're from Haran." He said, "You know Laban, son of Nahor?" They said, "Sure do." He said, "How's he doing?" "Well, fine," they said. "Here's his daughter Rachel coming with the sheep." He said, "Look, it's still broad daylight. It's not time for the animals to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them." But they said, "We can't till all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well. Then we water the sheep." Apparently it took several shepherds to team up to move this particular stone. So that's why they had to wait till there were enough people there to move the thing, and then they could do it. While he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept her father's sheep. Now when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, Jacob went up and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban. Did you see, you catch that? He had a little testosterone fit. One look at Rachel and, "Oh, I can move that stone roll by myself." Usually took three guys, but not when you've had a vision of that. So Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. When Laban heard the news about his sister's son Jacob, he ran to meet him, embraced him, kissed him, brought him to his house. Jacob told Laban all these things, and Laban said, "You are bone of my flesh," and he stayed with him a month. And Laban said to Jacob, you're my kinsman. You shouldn't serve me for nothing. What would you like as wages?" And of course, Jacob says, "I'll work if you let me have Rachel, your daughter, as my bride." They agree. He works for 7 years. And the narrator says these 7 years seem to him but a few days because of his love for Rachel. And then, as we all know, on the wedding night, Laban slips Leah, the older sister, into the tent instead of Rachel. And Leah becomes the wife. Jacob is fooled, and he has to work 7 more years to get the wife that he really wants. That's the second story. The third story is in Exodus chapter 2, verses 15 and following. This is now about 500 years later. Israel has been in slavery for several centuries in the land of Egypt, and Moses has been saved from the slaughter of Pharaoh, and he has grown to be a young man. He has murdered an Egyptian slave master, and he is on the run in the land of Midian. And at verse 15, we read, "When Pharaoh heard of this, he sought to kill Moses. So Moses fled from Pharaoh. He settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, 'How'd you get back here so soon today?' They said, 'Well, an Egyptian guy helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock.' Reuel said, 'Well, where is he? Why'd you leave him out there? Well, invite him in for heaven's sake.' So Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, 'I have been an alien residing in a foreign land.'" So there you go. 3 stories, 2 rather close in chronological time, one many centuries later. But stories with very close similarities, even though one of them is 60-some verses long, and the other one is only about 8 verses long or so. All the stories have precisely the same sequence of events and the same outline. And these scenes are related in ways that we're going to try to study today. Scholars call these things type scenes, scenes that have a typical way of proceeding and that you can examine for the way that they work. And biblical literature is just like every other form of human literature, saturated with these kinds of things. What I want to set up for you is something that I first learned from a Jewish biblical scholar by the name of Robert Alter in a book called The Art of Biblical Narrative, and he uses this particular kind of scene to show how type scenes work. And just so that we can then go back and do with these scenes in the Bible what we're accustomed to doing with them in our own culture, I want to talk about how we use these kinds of scenes, and then we'll go back and we'll see how these things work in the Bible. We have type scenes too. The ones with which you are most familiar are most likely from the movies, which is where they show up most in our, that's the storytelling mode of our culture for the most part. Novels and other literature have these things as well, but movies is where they show up best for us. Nowadays, I would say the most typical type scene is a chase scene. You cannot have an action movie without at least one chase scene. And this is, by the way, where you get the expression, cut to the chase. You know, forget the rest of the story, let's just have the chase scene. Because that's where things are going to come out. This is where things will kind of come to a head. And some of us are old enough to remember how every single cowboy movie, every old western, in the theater or on television, had a chase scene right near the end that was critical. Usually with two guys on horseback, one of them chasing the other, and the one behind could never, ever quite catch. Often they're shooting at each other, you know, one guy shooting forward, the other guy shooting backward. And somehow nobody ever gets hit, or rarely does anybody. So finally the guy in the back has to get just close enough that he can take his lasso, which just happens to be hanging there from the last rodeo. And he winds the thing up, and how they do this so accurately is hard to tell, but they always get the guy, pull him off his horse, beat the snot out of him. We've done it. We've managed to save the world again. Except we all know that every once in a while, you know, it's the bad guy chasing the good guy instead of the good guy chasing the bad guy, and every once in a while somebody does get shot. Every once in a while, even though the guy in the front gets lassoed, he's the one who wins the fist fight.
But it's always the same rock they're going by.
They always go by the same rock. Yes. Those of us who saw enough of those old westerns, we started recognizing the set. But there are always these different details. And every one of them had the same progression, but you always knew there would be some quirk. And that was the exciting part. What will be the quirk? The curious outcome of this use of that scene. Or there's the showdown on Main Street, where two guys, that's the other way you can end a Western movie, with a guy on either end of Main Street, and they're going to stand there with their guns and try to do the quick draw thing, you know, and whoever can draw fastest and shoot the other guy wins the town or whatever. And it always goes that way, and you know exactly what you're going to see when it starts, that the two guys will look real serious and they'll get on either end, you know, and everybody else will scatter behind wagon wheels and rain barrels and saloon doors and you know, benches at the general store, or they'll get up on the roof or hide underneath something or whatever. The whole town is hiding now while these two guys out there in the plain open area of Main Street get ready to do this. And you know exactly how it's going to work, and you wonder who's going to kill whom. How will it work this time? But you also know going in, this guy's a chicken. He doesn't have a chance. How in the world is he going to shoot that guy? And then you realize, oh yeah, we saw that guy up there on the roof with a rifle. And sometimes that's what happens. Somebody out of sight of the other two guys shoots just at the instant when these two guys are supposed to be shooting in. Everyone thinks the cowardly sheriff finally did it. Because nobody knows any better, and he wins the town. Something like this happened. There's a curiosity that'll happen for each one of these things that has to do with the real storyline of this film. You know, sometimes it's a left-handed person and a wrong gun, or a person who's only got one arm and they have a secret weapon somewhere. You know, so there's always some quirk. And that's what we love about these things. It's the quirks, it's the curiosities that make these things work. Well, what we have just witnessed in just three stories is a scene that shows us enough so that we know how the scene works. And then we can go back and look at the quirks. And then I'll show you what the quirks mean. So, what's the outline of the type scene known as Betrothal at the Well? I'm sorry I have to erase Mr. Slug. I will probably leave his head. So, the setup is Israelite fellow traveling outside his territory, and he comes to a well. What happens next?
A woman
shows up. What happens next? Watering happens. Then?
A kiss.
Every time?
They share their family history.
Well, first the woman runs home.
Hospitality?
Each time the woman runs home and says, I met a guy. And back home they say, where is he? Bring him here for hospitality. And then during dinner, negotiations. What? How shall we work out my daughter becoming your wife? Negotiations leading to betrothal. Now, you may have noticed a couple of other things. There are other features of these things that are fairly standard. You'll notice that in one way or another, in all the ones we've seen so far, timing is important. The first servant arrives at precisely the moment in the evening when it's time to water the flocks and the women come to the well. The second story, it's not time yet because we got to wait till the other shepherds get here because only then can we move the rock. The third story, Rule is absolutely astonished that they're home so soon. Wow, it went fast today. What happened? So timing is important. At least some element in not every one of them, but there's also the matter of what kind of woman is this who shows up. Rebecca is a virgin, fair to look upon, whom no man has ever known. Rachel is someone who kind of smoked Jacob just by stepping into the daylight, and so forth. So you have at least some quality in two of the three stories about who's the woman involved. So this is the outline.
Is there always some conflict?
Conflict?
Yes. Got to beat off that other bunch that's coming in. And
well, Jacob is he's fleeing. The conflict is in the first one. We don't want a foreign wife, I suppose. The third one is actually there's harassment going on as well. So there, it could be that there's difficulty somewhere in the neighborhood. In all the stories. Okay, but this, yeah.
That's a lot of hassle, but it's not as complicated as what I went through when I met my wife.
Well, I'm sure we could have some wild stories if we did that. So the quirks, what are the oddities? Now that you know how the general story works, let's go back and think about the first one with Isaac having Rebecca for a wife. What are the curiosities of that one, the most obvious ones?
And he didn't get to go.
Yeah, Isaac is not even present for his own betrothal. They sent somebody else to get him a wife. And then they give him the wife that somebody else went and get for him, and he says, well, okay. Anything else you saw that's different in that story than in the others?
Prophecy.
Okay, there's all this prophesying going on, and God seems to have a hand in directing the whole thing. This is the only one in which the person prays about, let this be the one, and then they have to keep sharing the story about, did God direct this or not? But
they asked her willingness.
Yeah. It's the only one in which they asked the woman, will you go along with this? Nobody asked Zipporah that we know of. We presume Rachel maybe liked Jacob too, but you ask the father, but not in the first story. There are a couple other things, but we got to do this in 1 hour. So now think about the life of Isaac and Rebecca. Isn't this totally typical of their life? This is Genesis chapter 26. 4 chapters earlier, Isaac was taken to a mountain where his father was going to kill him, and he says, this is kind of strange, Father. I don't see the sacrifice. And all of a sudden, he's got a knife over him. And from that point on, he's a really quiet guy. Through the whole rest of the story, he's Mr. Passive. And I'll just tell you, the name Rebecca is the Hebrew word for a noose. Not this kind, but the kind you lay on the ground, and when your prey steps into it, you snare them. It was a name you gave to a girl child in hopes that they would be beautiful enough to snare a husband. Captivating would be the most charitable way to say this name. And if you know the story of Isaac and Rebecca, you know that Rebecca is the one throughout the whole story who has everybody in her snare. She runs the show. She loved Jacob. Isaac loved Esau. Who ends up with all the blessing? Partly with mom's scheming help? Jacob, even though he's the younger and shouldn't have got the family blessing. Everything goes the way Rebecca wants it to go. And old Isaac, he's sort of half blind and he kind of doesn't know what's going on. And this is the story of his life already in his betrothal. Jacob. Quirks in that story.
It's the chase scene.
Pardon?
You have the chase scene that starts the story.
Okay. The chase?
He's running from his brother.
Well, he's running for his life, yeah. He's in trouble. Of course, so is Moses. Both of them are in trouble.
He's deceived.
Pardon?
He's deceived.
All right, he's deceived.
By Rachel's, or Rebecca's brother.
Yeah, he gets deceived. And he is himself a deceiver.
Right. Yeah.
So this story of his life is partly about deception. He's also the guy, remember, who's born second with his hand clutching his brother's heel, trying to pull him back in so that he can get ahead of him and be born first. And it doesn't quite work, and so he spends the rest of his life trying to get ahead of his brother, who he wasn't ahead of. His whole life is the hard work of trying to get ahead. This is the story of his betrothal too, right? He has to move this rock that it usually takes 3 guys to move all by himself. And then he's got to work 7 more years to get the wife he really wants. So the whole story of Jacob's betrothal is the story of his life and how things work out for him. And it's also the story of how the wife's life will work out. Rachel has to wait to become the bride, and she will have to wait for children. Leah will always get stuff first. So, that's their life, yeah.
And I always loved the story. Of course, he's very tricky. He gets the best sheep. He knows more about breeding sheep and stuff, so that's part of it. He ends up very... And I just loved when I learned in England one time that there still is a breed of sheep called Jacob's sheep. It's the name of it, and it's the dark brown one.
Yeah. Okay. The third story, quickly. What's curious about that one? What's the odd feature of Moses' story? All right, he's among people who aren't his own people, but then, of course, who are Moses' people? Moses is a man in the middle. You know, he's between two peoples.
His own mother is his nurse.
Pardon?
His own mother ends up feeding him, caring for him.
Okay, that's all true. I meant in his betrothal story.
Oh.
What are the quirks of Moses' betrothal story?
He's a rescuer.
Yeah, and the word, in fact, for what he does is he delivers. The word for saving, yasha. He delivers these seven daughters from these harassing shepherds. And this is Moses' role in life, right? Moses becomes the deliverer. So the point of these stories is that each one of them glimpses the life and career of the person about whom you tell this story. It's their life in microcosm. There are others of these that are not quite so obvious. Saul, the first king, gets one of these, and it fits his life perfectly. There's a story in 1 Samuel 9 about how Saul, after he's found out he's going to be the king, is headed for a well. He runs into some women who are apparently going to the same well, and instead of doing the watering thing and having the whole story play out, he says, "Have you seen the seer?" And the women say, "Yeah, he went that away." And he leaves the well and he goes chasing off to try to find Samuel, never does, offers some sacrifices himself that he shouldn't have done, and his life is derailed from that moment on. He should have just gone to the well. But no, his life went off in the wrong direction. So that's a perfectly predictive, typical well story for his life. There's a very interesting one in the book of Ruth, where a woman from outside the territory, a foreign woman, travels into Israelite territory. She meets this guy Boaz, who says, "Hey, if you need any water, my guys will get you some from the well. In the meantime, come in to dinner." They have dinner. After dinner, she lies down next to him. And the next thing you know, we got betrothal. So it's a reverse well story of how a foreign woman gets into the family of Israel with a lot of the same marks. Okay, so that's how these scenes work and what they predict for us in the Bible. Now, obviously some of you know exactly where this is going. We have one more well story, the one in John chapter 4. So now we're ready to look at the one in John chapter 4 and see. Now that we know how these things work, we can see the oddities of this story, and we can begin to see how this story teaches us something about John's understanding of Jesus. Just in case we might be a little inobservant and not be paying proper attention, chapter 3 in John has a setup for this. In verses 25 and following, a discussion arose about purification between John's disciples and a Jew. They came to John and asked him about the baptizing and so forth. And then at verse 28, John says, "You yourselves are my witnesses that I said, I am not the Messiah. I've been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, what we call the best man, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease." So John the Baptist says, "No, I'm not the Messiah. The Messiah is the bridegroom. I'm the best man, but I'm starting to hear the music. And sure enough, chapter 4, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard that Jesus is making and baptizing more disciples than John, although he really wasn't, he left Judea and started back to Galilee, but he had to go through Samaria. So he came to a Samaritan city called Sychar near the plot of ground Jacob had given his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. It was about noon. And he should be checking his pulse. If he knows his Bible well enough, and he should from Sunday school up in Nazareth. When a guy is outside of his turf and sits down by a well and a woman shows up, exciting things are about to happen. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." So far we got it all. Same story. His disciples were in town buying food. The Samaritan woman said, "How is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a Samaritan?" Jews don't share things in common, the narrator tells us, in case we're not in on that. Jesus says, "Well, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that's talking to you, saying, 'Give me a drink,' you'd ask him and he'd give you living water." So here's the excuse for why we can do this today. The woman said, "Sir, you don't even have a bucket. This is a deep well. Where are you going to get this living water? You're greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well." Jesus said, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But those who drink of the water that I give them will never be thirsty. The water that I give will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming back here." So, as happens so often in John, there's this spiritual talk of one kind coming from Jesus, and everybody's trying to take it literally, just like Nicodemus, you know, in the previous chapter. "Oh, I got to be born again, be 6 pounds, 7 ounces." All the woman can think about is buckets. Jesus says, "Go call your husband. Come back." The woman said, "I don't have one." Jesus says, "You got that right." And then they discuss the fact that she's had 5 and now lives with someone who's not a husband. Torah allowed you 3 marriages. After 3 marriages, you were no longer eligible for marriage. But this woman has been in 5 and is in now yet another relationship. Then we get a discussion that is important for what we're doing, because it's a discussion about where people worship. Do you worship at temples? The Samaritans had their temple. The Jews have their temple. Each of them thought they had the proper temple, just like in the old days of Jeroboam and Rehoboam, in the aftermath of Solomon and so forth. But Jesus says, look, the hour is coming, verse 23. In fact, it's here now, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as those to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And of course, what we know if we're studying the whole gospel is that Jesus himself is the temple from which will, which is the place for the presence of God, and from which will flow this living water that Jesus is talking about. Well, the woman says, "I know the Messiah is coming." Jesus says, "That's me. I am the Messiah," one of the many "I am" sayings in John's Gospels. Then the disciples come back. They're astonished that he's speaking with a woman. The woman left her water jar and went back to the city. The woman runs home, usually in haste. This one leaves her jar behind, hustles off home, and says to the people back home, "Come see a man who told me everything I ever did. Can't be the Messiah, huh?" So they left the city, and they're on their way to meet him. Then we have a conversation we're going to ignore between Jesus and the disciples about food. But the Samaritans from that city come, invite Jesus to come with them. He does. He stayed with them for 2 days, verse 40. And many more believed because of his word, and they said it's no longer because of what you said to the woman, but what we now ourselves have heard. And when the 2 days were over, Jesus went from that place to Galilee, and when he came to Galilee, they welcomed him, and then he's off into some other adventures. So there's Jesus' story. It's got pretty much all the parts, just like the rest of the stories do. What are its quirks? What are the things that that are the curiosities and the clues to the outcome of Jesus' life?
Well, the woman certainly wasn't pure.
All right, this is an ineligible bride. This is not a virgin fair to look upon whom no one has ever known, no man has ever known, like
Rebecca. She came out at noon.
Pardon me?
She came out at noon rather than evening.
All right, we have the time again. It's in the middle of the day in one of the couple of the other stories, but yeah, it's precisely at noon, we're told, and we have an ineligible bride. What else?
Well, the barrier wasn't that the stone needed to be rolled away, but they didn't have buckets. They were concerned about buckets.
All right, Jesus doesn't have a bucket, and the woman loses her bucket. But that's not all. Does anybody get a drink? No, there's a lot of talk about drinking, but nobody gets a drink. Jesus does not get a drink. They talk about it. Jesus says, hey, I got living water for you. And the woman says, I'd like to have some of that so I don't have to keep coming back here. Did the woman get her drink? Maybe she starts to get in on something like what the real drink should be by the end of the story when she realizes, along with her fellow Samaritans, that they have met the Messiah and start to believe this. But the watering is incomplete. At the well, Jesus doesn't get a drink. But most importantly, he leaves town without a bride. The betrothal is incomplete. We have all the rest of the parts, but no betrothal.
Isn't it almost a foretaste of Jesus' acceptance of anyone, no matter who they are or what they are? Almost.
Yeah, I think it is, but we got to figure out a way to get there.
Yeah.
How is he going to marry this woman? How is he going to take this five times broken-hearted woman, now trying a sixth relationship, how is he going to make her his betrothed? Well, we don't have that much time. I'm going to have to just do this. You know from John's Gospel, and only in John's Gospel, that there's going to be a time when, again at noon, Jesus will ask for a drink. In the other Gospels, Jesus is crucified at 9 o'clock in the morning. And in Matthew and Mark, the only thing he says is just before he dies, he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? In John's Gospel, he is crucified. He's not even given a death sentence till noon. Now he's crucified then. And only in John does he say, I thirst. Give me a drink. And the drink that they give him in English is some sour wine on hyssop, a sponge stuck to a hyssop branch. And that sour wine is called oxus. In Greek, we call it wine vinegar. In Hebrew, it's called chometz, as opposed to yayin, which is regular wine. And it's precisely the drink that Ruth got at her betrothal dinner. The foreign woman. Jesus gets a drink that completes his betrothal when once again he asks for a drink at noon, and this time he gets one. It's also, of course, the cup that the Father gave him, the cup of death, but it's the cup by which he takes his bride, which is then how Later on, the book of Revelation, in the area where we've been at the end of the sessions these last several days, in Revelation 19 and following, let me just read this again to you quickly. And the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And then I saw the heavens open and so forth, and the city of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem coming down, adorned as a bride to meet the bridegroom. And Jesus is the bridegroom. And where did he take his bride? On the cross, where his betrothal is finally completed. And who is the bride?
The New Jerusalem.
All the baptized, the New Jerusalem, the people of the city called Yahweh Shema. Yahweh is there. So this is how Jesus becomes the bridegroom. Like he accomplishes everything else in John's gospel, it happens in the crucifixion. In this moment, all the promises strung throughout John's gospel come true. And tomorrow we're going to do a whole bunch more so that I can show you how Jesus becomes, as Stan was asking yesterday, the tree in the middle from which flows life and which becomes a fountain of living water for the whole world. But this is where Jesus becomes the bridegroom. And this is how this Johanna narrator uses these ancient water well stories, well known to people throughout the ages of Jewish Israelite storytelling. He uses this same artistic convention to try to do some theology and teach us that Jesus is our bridegroom. And he takes us to be his own, to have and to hold in all circumstances from this time forth and even forevermore. So we should all now say to each other, congratulations. The marriage is complete. Questions, comments? Yeah.
I was always told that in this particular well story in John, that the significance of the noon hour was that the woman was avoiding the other well women because of her reputation.
That's the common interpretation throughout the centuries, that this is a sign of this woman's status and even her iniquitous life. In fact, you know, before I caught on to what's really going on here after reading Robert Alter and coming to my senses, I remember once preaching as a young preacher that what this woman came to the well for, you couldn't take home in a bucket. Because that's why women came to a well at noon. You were up to no good if you came to the well at noon. And maybe on one level, that's what we have here. We have a story of a woman who is shunned, and she has to come to the well at a time when no one else would come. But what the real point of coming at noon is that this is the hour when you meet the one who will cry out in the noonday in his own thirst and beg for a drink that will become his betrothal drink. So much more importantly than her status becomes this moment when you connect with the crucified. I mean, it serves both purposes. She's at the well at the wrong time. There's no question about it.
It seems odd to me that that would be acceptable as her status, since when she goes to the village, she speaks up about who she is and that this man has told her everything about herself. So she's obviously not ashamed of that. And also then they believe her, which is, I mean, she's a woman.
Yeah.
It's not the testimony of two women, it's one woman.
Yeah.
And so those two things don't really fit.
Her pariah status seems to have no bearing in the rest of the story. So if she had that, it was not important to her village. They play their role the way they're supposed to play it. When she goes back and tells them, I met a guy, they say, okay, bring him here. That's how the stories work. All right, it's 10 o'clock. Tomorrow we will wrap up once more. We will go from Genesis to Revelation. And mostly we'll be in John's Gospel tomorrow. We're going to see where all this living water comes out of Jesus.